Hey. Hare Krishna. Maybe everybody can come. Everybody can come closer. Hare Krishna. So, how is everyone doing? Hare Krishna. So, this morning, Kaivalya Prabhu was telling me that I discuss about the three modes of material nature. But then when I thought over it, then I felt that probably while discussing about the three modes of material nature, we can also add the aspect of spiritual nature. So material nature and spiritual nature. So that is the topic for today's discussion. Material nature is not difficult to understand because we are already here. But at the same time, it is important to know the intricacies of material nature. How does it function? How does the material nature function? What is the material nature? How does it operate? How does it function? And why we are here and what we are supposed to do here. When we are in the material nature, in the context of material nature, it is important that we understand that. Is the sound system all right? Everybody can, I can see that the volume has been increased. So, so this material nature, when we analyze the material nature, or rather when we approach the scriptures, then we can see that the material nature has been defined in a certain way. There are two ways of seeing things. Again, another consideration. Like, the way we see it from our perspective, and the other consideration is one is the direct perception, the way we see things, and the other is the way it is, way it actually is. Our direct perception has been considered to be fallible or imperfect. How the direct perception can be imperfect or misleading, in that respect there is an example that one Englishman was going by water body, going by a river where some washermen were washing the clothes. You know, in India, how the washermen wash their clothes? They have a piece of stone and then they hit it on, they take the cloth and hit it on the stone, and that's how they clean the stone, clean the cloth. And so the Englishman described that these people here are so stupid that I saw a man trying to break a stone with a piece of cloth. So that is the fallacy of direct perception. It may appear to be in a certain way to us, but that is not what it actually is. So the Vedic approach or the Vedic philosophical approach has very systematically defined the material nature. And this perception or this understanding is receiving the knowledge through the descending process. So this can be described that knowledge can be acquired in two different ways. One is through our direct perception, which is the ascending process, and the other is knowledge imparted by a higher authority who has the information and gives us the knowledge. That becomes a easier way and a proper way to receive knowledge. Like we can consider that, how did we learn the alphabets? A simple thing as alphabet, we had to learn it from somebody who just gave the knowledge, like the mother or a teacher told us this is A, this is B, and we accepted it. This is A and this is B. And that's how we actually understood. We learned the alphabets. But if we had to learn the alphabets through our own endeavor, how difficult it would have been to figure out what is A and what is B by dint of our own endeavor. It would have been practically impossible to receive the knowledge. So, the proper way of learning or proper way of receiving knowledge is through the descending process, receiving the knowledge from a higher authority or a bona fide source. So the bona fide source, again, the actual bona fide source of receiving knowledge is the Vedas. The Vedas, what are the Vedas? Vedas are the knowledge that has been given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead at the time of creation. He gave the knowledge. And there was no need for speculation, there was no need for research, there was no need for making all kinds of endeavor to know different things. The best way to receive knowledge is through receiving it from a bona fide source. And which source could have been more authentic and authoritative than the Supreme Personality of Godhead Himself? So, Vedas not only deal with material nature, Vedas actually makes us transcend the material nature and come to the spiritual nature. And the Vedas have been summarized in two different... The Vedas are flowing. Vedic wisdom is generally flowing in two different branches. One branch is known as Upanishad and the other branch is known as Puranas. And of the Upanishads, Upanishad, the word Upanishad means... Upa means near, Ni means sitting, and Shat means a higher authority or a teacher. The knowledge that has been received by sitting at the feet of a bona fide spiritual master, that is Upanishad. The students used to go to the Guru's ashram and there they used to receive the knowledge from the spiritual master Guru. And the other branch of knowledge is Puran, the descriptions of the activities of the Lord and His devotees. So these are the two branches, the Vedas. Although Vedas have various aspects, but when it comes to receiving information, generally they are in these two specific branches, Upanishads and Purans. And of all the Upanishads, the greatest or the essence of all Upanishad is Bhagavad Gita or Gita Upanishad. And essence of all Purans is Srimad Bhagavatam. And you can see, Srila Prabhupada actually presented the Vedic wisdom specifically through these two scriptures, Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Not only Srila Prabhupada, this is what Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu made his presentation through Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavad Gita is the beginning aspect, and Puran is the Srimad Bhagavatam is the conclusive aspect. Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam. Bhagavad Puran is the ultimate proof of Krishna's identity as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, when you go through, when you make this approach, especially the initial approach when you make through Bhagavad Gita, we can see Bhagavad Gita is describing the material nature very systematically. Bhagavad Gita has defined the material nature. Krishna described the material nature through just one shloka, one verse. The entire material nature has been analyzed through just one verse. Bhumi rapo analo vayu khang mano buddhi devacha ahankara ityang me bhinna prakritir ashtadha. See the profundity of his presentation. Just one verse described the entire material nature. The material nature is consisting of bhumi, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. With these eight elements, this entire material nature has been composed of. But this material nature, Krishna is saying, bhinna prakritir, is my separated energy. This material nature is not directly connected to Krishna. Therefore, this material nature is separated from Krishna. Separated, bhinna prakriti. Separate energy, separate prakriti, separate nature of mind. Why it is separate? Because Krishna doesn't directly get involved in this material nature. The affairs of the material nature is controlled or organized by Krishna's appointed agents, the demigods, starting from Lord Brahma. They are actually taking care of all the affairs of the material nature. Bhinna prakriti. Ashtadha. But then he is saying that aparayamitastannam. This is my separated energy, but prakritim vidhi me parang. Beyond that, there is another nature which is superior. Prakritim vidhi me param. This is apara, means inferior, and beyond that, there is a para prakriti, superior nature of mine. Para. Aparayam itastannang prakritim vidhi me param and jiva bhutang mahabaho jajedang dharjate jagat. The living entities, jiva bhutang, the living entities are coming from that superior nature of mind. And these living entities are sustaining this material nature or exploiting this material nature. So, this is how Krishna is, just in two verses, Krishna is describing the material nature and transcending the material nature and taking us to the spiritual nature. Unless and until we transcend the material nature, we will not be able to understand the spiritual reality. We have to, at some point, we have to transcend it. We have to do it systematically. Like, there is no need to just blindly accept it or blindly consider that we have to accept it. There is no need for that. It's okay. There is no need for that blindly accepting it. We have to systematically understand it, and we have to transcend the material nature. Sometimes some approach is made, like through science we'll understand the spiritual nature. No, material science will never be able to understand the spiritual reality. Modern science is trying to probe into consciousness. But through matter, they'll never be able to understand what is consciousness. At some point, they have to transcend matter to understand that it is completely opposed to the material nature. Unless and until we come to that understanding, unless and until we accept it, we'll never be able to properly understand the spiritual reality. In simple words, we can say, probing into darkness will never be able to understand light. If we probe into darkness, go deeper and deeper and deeper into darkness, will we ever be able to understand what light is? No. Because darkness is absence of light. So in order to understand what light is, we have to transcend darkness and get into the another dimension, that is light. And Krishna did that in Bhagavad Gita. And Shankha philosophy also does that in a very systematic way. Krishna, of course, did it in one verse, whereas Shankha philosophy does it in a very elaborate way, in an extensive, through extensive research. They analyze that there are five elements: earth, water, fire, air, ether. Then we have five senses: eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and touch. These five senses interact with five elements, and five objects of the senses are created. Then there are five working senses. So the total there are 20. Five fours are 20. Then they consider that there are three subtle elements: mind, intelligence, and false ego. Man, buddhi, and ahankar. They are also matter, but subtle matter. Man, buddhi, and ahankar. So 23. Then they consider the sum total of the material elements. The subtlest of the material elements, from which all material elements have become manifested. So that is the Mahatattva. So with this 24 consideration, they analyze the entire material nature. But then they consider that all these elements, all these considerations are objective in nature. But the objects cannot exist without the subject. The observer has to be there to perceive the object. So who is the observer? I am here, that's why I am exposed to this material nature. Now this I couldn't be found anywhere else. On this 24 consideration, the I was missing. I couldn't be found. Therefore, I is beyond this 24 consideration. Therefore, I is beyond material nature, beyond matter. Therefore, I is non-material, hence spiritual. This is how systematically, through, you can say, analytical study, or analytical research, they are coming to that point. But again, Prabhupada is saying that that when you know the subject, then there is no need for research. Research is necessary when you do not know the topic. When you know it, then what's the need for research? So those who do not know, let them make the research. But when we accept the Vedas, then there is no need for research. We simply have to accept it. So the acceptance is that we have to accept, and we can use our common sense, whether it makes sense. That's what we actually have to consider. Does it make sense? That if, let's consider, if I am not here, will this nature be here? Obviously not. We notice that when you fall asleep, does this nature exist for us? No, we do not know whether it is or it is not. Similarly, when we die, it won't be here anymore for us. So who is sustaining, for whom this material nature is existing? Krishna is saying in simple words, Jajedang dharjate jagat. The living entities are sustaining this material nature. In simple words, we can say, when there won't be any living entity, what will happen to the material nature? Will there be anyone to observe this material nature? The answer is no. And the Vedas are describing that is the abhyakta state, unmanifest stage. And when the living entities are here, then it is a vyakta or manifested stage. So Prakriti has two aspects. Abhyakta dini bhutani, vyakta madhyani bharata, abhyakta nidhana neva tatra kapari devana. This material nature was unmanifest, in the middle it has become manifest, and again it will become unmanifest. When it will become unmanifest? When does it become manifest? When the living entities are projected into the material nature. And that happens through the glance of Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu looks at the material nature and the material nature becomes manifest because the living entities are projected into the material nature through his glance. So in this way, it has been described that this material nature is Krishna's inferior energy. Krishna is not directly involved in that. Now what is the meaning of this inferior material nature? The inferior material nature means it has been made with a purpose where Krishna is directly not involved. An example can be given, the king's kingdom and the prison house. Prison house is not really necessary for the king's. King doesn't need the prison house himself. It's not for his sake that he needs the prison house. But the prison house is needed. Why? For the criminals. For the criminals to rectify their perverted consciousness. Reform themselves. To reform the criminals, the prison house is needed. So the material nature is necessary to rectify the perverted consciousness of some individuals. The individuals whose consciousness has become polluted, to rectify those consciousness, this material nature is necessary. And who are those defected individuals, defective individuals? Us. Who have rejected Krishna. Our crime is, or our defect is, we have rejected Krishna. In order to rectify our consciousness, rectify our mentality, this material nature became necessary. And this that is the purpose of the material nature, to rectify our consciousness. In the prison house, what happens? In the prison house, the criminals are punished. What is the purpose of punishment? To make them understand that they have done something wrong. And to teach them, to remind them that not to do that, that they shouldn't do that. So similarly, the living entities, those who have rejected Krishna in the material nature, they are being treated by Maya, Mahamaya. And this Mahamaya, you can say, is like the prison in charge. And this prison in charge has some special ability or special means to rectify the consciousness. How does she do that? Daivihesha gunamoyi mamamaya durattaya. Gunamoyi. The definition of the material nature or Mahamaya has been given as Doibi. First of all, Krishna is saying that this material nature or Mahamaya is my divine energy. Doibi Yesha. Gunamoyi, it's endowed. Maya, she is endowed with three gunas. Gunamoyi. The mode of goodness, mode of passion, mode of ignorance. Gunamoyi. And it's Durattaya. It's very difficult to overcome the influence, or it's very difficult to surmount this material nature. But then Krishna is making another point. Mamevaje prapadante mayametantarantite. When one surrenders unto me, then very easily he overcomes this Maya. Tarantite can get across this Maya. So now this, we are here, we are coming into the influence of Maya, or the functioning of Maya. Gunamayi, three modes. Out of the three modes, mode of ignorance, mode of passion, mode of goodness. The mode, generally, the activities of this material nature is conducted by passion and ignorance. The involvement in the material nature takes place through the mode of passion. And that mode of passion leads to unconsciousness or ignorance. One becomes involved in the activities of the material nature and becomes very, very, very involved, very actively involved, and then he becomes tired and he falls asleep. That is the general functioning of the living entities in the material nature. Living entities become very active. Like during the day, we work so hard. We become very active. And then in the evening, we become tired and then we fall asleep. Passion to ignorance. And then in the morning, again we wake up and again we become actively involved in the mode of passion, and again we get into the mode of ignorance. That's the general functioning of the material nature due to these two modes. Passion, ignorance, then ignorance to passion, then passion to ignorance, is cycling in this way. But there is another mode which actually leads us out of this cycle of passion and ignorance. That is the mode of goodness. The more we become situated in the mode of goodness, more we will become relieved from the cycle of passion and ignorance. We'll stand aside. Mode of goodness will let us withdraw from this material nature. But in this material nature, mode of goodness is not pure. It is always tinged with passion and ignorance, because it is material. So in simple words, we can, in another way, we can say that the mode of passion and ignorance is the original modes that influences the material nature. And mode of goodness is actually the spiritual mode. And the spiritual influence is causing the mode of goodness to prevail in this material nature. Therefore, the pure goodness is beyond this material nature. The reflection or the semblance of mode of goodness in the material nature is there in the form of material goodness. But the real goodness, the pure goodness, is beyond this material nature. Therefore, material goodness is always tinged with passion and ignorance. Now, how can we become situated in pure goodness? Is by surrendering to Krishna. That is the only way we can reach the pure goodness. Otherwise, the activities in the mode of goodness in the material nature is not really pure goodness. Or this material goodness cannot take us beyond the jurisdictions of material nature. So they can make us transcend the influence of passion and ignorance to some extent, but the actual transcendence will be in the mode of pure goodness. Sometimes we see that people acting in a mode of goodness, like they're vegetarians, their activities are quite pure, and so and so forth. But still it is not pure goodness. When will this goodness become pure goodness? When they surrender themselves to Krishna. Then only they will be situated in pure goodness. then only they will be able to literally transcend the influence of the modes of material nature. So, in this way, we can see that there are there is a way, and that way, the means is actually very simple to transcend the material nature. Just surrender unto Krishna. Krishna time and time again made that point. Just surrender unto me. Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam braja. It's as simple as that. Just surrender. Surrender is not difficult. To act against it and struggle, that is difficult. And especially to struggle against an opponent like Krishna's in Krishna's own energy. It's impossible. That's what Krishna is saying. It's impossible. Durattaya. Durattaya. It's impossible. But if you surrender to me, then it becomes easy. Maya me tang tarantite. So we have two options. Struggle against the influence of material nature, or just accept the authority of Krishna and surrender unto him. Now what would be the intelligent approach? Krishna made that point very clearly in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna is asking that between these two, those who accept your personal feature and surrender unto you, and those who just accept your impersonal aspect and try to transcend the material nature, between these two, who is better? Who is better off? And Krishna very clearly, very simply says that those who surrender unto me, those who become my devotee, those who render devotional service unto me in a submissive way, for them it is very easy, and they are situated in a perfect platform. But those who try to approach the impersonal way, those who are attached to my impersonal aspect, for them it is very, very difficult. Klesha adhikatara stesham. Klesha means suffering. And adhikatara means more and more, increasing suffering. Stesham, abhyakta shakta chetasham. Those who are attached to my abhyakta aspect. That means my unmanifested, impersonal aspect is simply, it'll, because abhyakta hi gatir dukkham, because abhyakta simply leads to suffering. Krishna has two aspects. He is both. He has his personal aspect and he has his impersonal aspect. It is not wrong to say that impersonal aspect is also Krishna or the Supreme or the Absolute Truth. Impersonal aspect is real. But that approach is simply going to lead us to more and more suffering. Whereas when we accept his personal aspect and surrender unto him, that is very easy. Just consider, you have to fight a wrestling match. And your opponent is very strong. There is no way you can win. If you are intelligent, what will you do? As you go into the wrestling arena, you see your opponent, a huge giant like personality, and if you are going to struggle against him, you'll be beaten to pulp. So the intelligent approach would be, well, okay, I'm not going to fight with you. I accept defeat. I surrender unto you. Now tell me, who can be more powerful than Krishna? He is the supreme powerful. So why struggle against the supreme powerful personality? Just surrender unto him. And that's so simple. If you, when you surrender unto Him, then you see that that personality whom you had been thinking to be your competitor is actually your dearmost friend and loving father. And He is the supreme proprietor of everything. He is the controller of everything. So why not just surrender unto Him? So that is what Krishna is trying to remind us through His instructions in Bhagavad Gita and all the scriptures. Hare Krishna. Does anybody have any question? Yes?
Thank you for class. During the process of destruction, what is the difference between the pranaya when Brahma's day and night gets over and when Brahma's 100 years gets over?
Okay. When Brahma's day is over, day is over and it becomes Brahma's night, then everyone in the universe falls asleep along with Brahma. Right? You see, the difference between sleep and death is that, you know, death is also sleep, or sleep also is death. The only difference is that in sleep you wake up in the same body, and in death you wake up in another body. Right? That's both are sleep. So when the Brahma's day is over and his night comes, then all the creatures, all the living entities in the universe goes to a long, long sleep. Right? 4.32 billion years. But when Brahma's life is over, then the whole universe is dissolved. Then all the living entities go back to Kshiradakshaya Vishnu, in the body of Kshiradakshaya Vishnu. This is the night of Brahma, and the at the end of the universe, Brahma's 100 years over, Brahma is dead. So along with Brahma, the entire universe is destroyed.
At the pralaya?
Yeah, one day after. No, you actually started off with another question. You said that at the end of Kali Yuga.
Yeah, there's one more.
There are different, you see, there are different types of pralayas. Temporary pralaya. The one kind of pralaya is the individual pralaya at the time of death. Now that is pralaya, finished. Right? Then there are pralayas, you know, at the end of the yugas. There are pralayas at the time of Manvantara, when the Manu changes. Then also, this way there are different types of pralayas, going all the way up to Mahavishnu withdrawing his glance. When he withdraws his glance, then all the living entities from this material nature is withdrawn from him. It's inconceivable how it is. So there are temporary pralayas and there are ultimate pralaya. The ultimate pralaya, absolute pralaya, is when the thing is. And so everyone falls, at that time, you know, everyone falls asleep. Like as you were saying, temporary pralaya. One kind of pralaya, the living entities can go to Jamalaya, Jamraja's abode, after death. And there they undergo various kinds of punishments. Brahma's day, end of the Brahma's day, then everything in the universe actually comes to a standstill. It's everything stops. So at that time, the living entities just merge into, they fall asleep, but they remain in the universe. Because the universe is not destroyed, the universe is there. So they fall asleep, but they remain in the universe. When Brahma's day is over, then all the living entities along with Brahma go into the body of Vishnu. It's like that. Although they go into the body of Vishnu, although they come so close to Vishnu, but they are not aware of Vishnu because they are asleep. Like say, if you fly by a plane, go to India and you are sleeping, and then the plane comes back to America, would you know that you've been to India? So similarly, going back to Mahavishnu's body is not really giving us the awareness of Mahavishnu. It's a matter of consciousness. As long as our consciousness is not projected onto Krishna through love and devotion, we cannot possibly wake up in that region, spiritual realm. Hare Krishna. Yes?
I have a question about preaching. You always preach so eloquently and simplistically, it seems like everyone can understand. And recently, preaching among yogis and spiritualists who are just dabbling with Krishna consciousness and trying different paths, but coming back and going away, coming back, recently got into the topic of absolute truth. And it seemed to be a very delicate topic. I was a little surprised to see how sensitive people were. And then I thought maybe in using that term, we're sounding like, and please don't take offense, but born-again Christians. You know, so often we use that term and we know what we mean because people are a little fanatical and very tunnel vision. So I found myself in discussing this topic of absolute truth with regard to Krishna consciousness, sometimes bordering that response from the other person, like a little defensiveness. So I was curious, how would you present the terminology of absolute truth within Krishna consciousness to someone who is just beginning that path of Krishna consciousness?
Well, there are when you coined that phrase, absolute truth, then along with that comes another consideration, relative truth. Right. So relative truths are in relation to individuals or individuals or extended individuals. Like, you know, something may be good for me but not good for others. So it's relative goodness. Right. In a broader sphere, something may be good for America but not good for Iraq. Right. Something may be good for the earth but not good for heavenly planets, right? So these are the relative considerations. But when that consideration goes all the way to Krishna, then it is absolute. Like, to simplify that point, I'll say that you water the leaves of the tree, it's absolute water, it's relative watering the tree. You treat the water the branches of the tree, relative. Even the trunk of the tree is relative. But when you water the root, then it's absolute. The entire tree is benefiting from that. But those who are connected to the tree, the leaves that have fallen off the tree will not get the benefit. Right? So, the truth or things that are in relation to Krishna, then it will benefit anyone and everyone who is connected to Krishna. But those who are not connected to Krishna, it may or may not benefit them. But indirectly it will. Because watering the root, you are actually... Because Krishna is the root of everything. Therefore, when you do something in relation to Krishna, then everybody gets the benefit. Otherwise, until we reach that point, it will always be a relative consideration.
Mm. Sometimes they don't make the connection. So I sometimes say, well, Jesus was praying to the Father. Who was the Father?
Right.
You know, so would that be the next comment?
Right. Yes. Yes. Like the thing is, we have to go to the depth of what Jesus said, what Jesus taught, what Muhammad taught. Right? Like Muhammad is saying, you know, Allah. Who is the Allah? Supreme. So how many Supremes are there? Can the Supreme be more than one? So now let's find out who is that Supreme. Prabhupada's point was that I am telling Krishna is the Supreme. Who is your Supreme? Where does he stay? What does he look like? What's his name? You don't have any information. So if you don't have any information, you have to accept my information. Hare Krishna. Yes.
You're talking about how surrender is actually not hard, but when we're practicing Krishna consciousness, it does feel like surrender is hard. So I was hoping that you could explain what it is that stops us from surrendering, and also what the symptoms are of surrender, so that we know where we are in this path when we're analyzing our own lives.
Well, as long as the surrender is hindered by our false ego, until then point, you know, the surrender is actually, we are making an endeavor to surrender, but the surrender is not complete. So that is a sadhana stage, a practicing stage of surrender. But when there is no hindrance, total, you know, it's spontaneous, total acceptance of Krishna and surrender, that is the perfect stage of surrender. Does it answer your question? Yeah. Yes?
When you talk to anyone in India, they would say, Krishna and the Dashavataras or Avataras of Vishnu. Where does that misinformation start? How did it become so?
It's not misinformation. You see, it's a way of perception. Like the way, you see, if you, again, you know, ultimately it's a matter of information. Right? Knowledge is actually the matter of information. Like you have some information, from that perspective you look at it, you get one kind of perception. But you get higher information, then you get another perception. Like all these avatars are Krishna's incarnation. But then again, these avatars are also Kshirodakshay Vishnu's expansions. In the material nature, all the incarnations are expansions of Kshirodakshay Vishnu. So when you look at it from the material point of, from this angle, then you know these avatars are expansions of Vishnu. And when you see Krishna even, then he will appear also as an expansion of Vishnu. There is no problem in that perception. But when you go get the proper spiritual information, and again, here, you know, we have to resort to the scriptures, because the authority of the scriptures we have to accept. And you come to Srimad Bhagavatam, which is actually giving the most elaborate and most profound informations, then we get another perception. That perception is that beyond this material nature is the spiritual sky. The spiritual sky is Vaikuntha. But beyond Vaikuntha is Golok, Vrindavan. So in Vrindavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his original identity is performing his eternal pastimes with his associates. Now, as I said, like it's a matter of informations. Those who have the informations, they know. Those who do not have the informations, they are unaware of it. Now, you see, and what are the avatars, the incarnations? The incarnations are the Supreme Personality of Godhead coming to the material nature to perform certain, to serve certain purpose. Like he comes to establish law and order. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that the purpose of his coming here is simply to establish the law and order, and that law and order is called dharma. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. Whenever there is the law and order, there is a disruption of law and order, he comes to establish the law and establish order. So that purpose of his coming is usually through Kshirodakshai Vishnu. But sometimes the original Supreme Personality of Godhead comes once in a day of Brahma. That is, many people do not have that information. That this Krishna is not an incarnation. Krishna is not an avatar. Krishna is the avatari, the source of all incarnations. What is the proof? Bhagavatam is describing various incarnations. 22 different incarnations have been described. Then it is said, Bhagavatam is saying that just as there are innumerable rivers coming out of the ocean and then merging into the back into the ocean, just as there are innumerable waves in the ocean, there are innumerable incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But Krishna is the source or origin of all those incarnations. Ete changsha kala pungsha, Krishna stu Bhagavan swayam. So Krishna is not an avatar, Krishna is an avatari. So it's only a matter of, you know, getting the right source of information and being enlightened by that information. We are very fortunate that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came and revealed that fact. Bhagavatam had been there, but prior to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this understanding was not clear. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu made that point clear. And then we are very fortunate that Srila Prabhupada came and distributed that knowledge throughout the world. And as a result of that, you know, we are benefiting from that. Thank you. You had a question? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, a servant and a child is treated very much differently. But in our spiritual lives, we aspire to be the servant of God. And at the same time, we read that we are children of God. So that seems quite...
Right. Yeah. Like, again, it's a matter of information. If you think that the Lord is your master, then you'll behave with him like a servant. But when you recognize that he is your father, he'll behave with him in a different way. Right? So it's a matter of, you know, again, information. And who is providing those informations? The spiritual master is providing those informations. But at the same time, we begin with as a servant, with Vaidhi Bhakti, with awe and reverence. We cannot, you know, like we have become so far removed from him. The relationship has become so remote that we already forgot that he is our father. Therefore, at the beginning stage, you know, we approach him like a servant. But then as we come closer to him, then he reveals to us that he is our father. And automatically the relationship develops accordingly. And not only as a father, then we get to know he's our friend. Then we get to know that he's our son. Right? Then you get to know he's our lover. So the degree of intimacy develops as he is revealing himself to us. So that, you know, like we begin as a servant. then it's up to him how he wants to treat us. We do not demand, no, I want to become your friend. I want to become your lover. I want to become a gopi. No. Our mood is like, somehow or other, I just want to engage myself in your service. And the rest is up to you. Hare Krishna. And to elaborate on that point, I can just give another example. A prisoner is suffering in the prison. Right? But then, he gets to know that surrendering to the king is going to free him from his imprisonment. So he surrenders to the king. And then eventually he gets to know that the king is actually his father. He's a prince. But as a prisoner, he couldn't even, in his remotest dream, he couldn't think that he's a prince. He was just a prisoner, suffering in that condition. So, yes. Yeah, sure. Ultimately, it all depends in our purity. Like, as we become pure, we get to know him better and better. And then accordingly, the relationship is revealed, because that is there already. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prem Saddha Kobhunai Shravanadi Shuddha Chitte Karai Udai. As through hearing and chanting, Shravanadi, Shuddha Chitte, purified heart. When the heart becomes purified by the process of practicing devotional service, it will become manifested. It is there already. Our relationship with Krishna is already there. But it has been forgotten because, you know, we have lost the memory. We have been completely covered over. And now as the heart becomes purified, that relationship becomes more and more clear. And eventually it becomes fully manifest. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true. And that brings up another point actually, that our propensities, we do not have to change, right? See, if we are in a certain mode, we developed the characteristics due to the influence of the mode, right? The wonderful aspect of Krishna consciousness is, we don't have to change our nature. We simply have to transform our purpose. Instead of doing it for ourselves, do it for Krishna. Arjuna is a warrior in the mode of passion. But he's using that mode, fighting the battle for Krishna. Therefore, he's transcending the modes of material nature. And that's what Krishna consciousness is. Just be what you are, but do it for Krishna.
When we first come into ISKCON, the philosophy captures us, and then we realize that we are living in a society which is a little more challenging. So when we talk about our natures, you can see when we're, as Haryashka just said, as we properly situate ourselves and adjust our lifestyle to be more Krishna conscious, then our nature doesn't seem to interfere so much. But sometimes people will say, well, that's my nature, and it causes a lot of havoc and a lot of discontent, especially if we're in a position of leadership. So I was listening to you talk about Krishna and our relationship as servant, and it seems like this is a practice ground for us when we are involved in committees, for example. We all come in with the idea that we want to have an equal voice, but yet there are different positions. So how do we, is it, but we all want to have a different experience, we all want to bring our experience to the table, we all want our opinions heard, and yet sometimes, you know, we don't have the authority to do anything with that opinion. So when it's our nature, it seems like sometimes we have to temper that nature as we're becoming better servants when we're sitting among senior devotees.
Yeah.
Or what is our purpose for even having all these meetings? We don't want to blind follow, because that seems silly. It's like a dictatorship. Why even have a meeting if we can't have an opinion?
We are having a meeting now.
<That's true. laughs> But when it comes to other types of meetings, it doesn't always seem, maybe we're more surrendered in this environment, or maybe we need to carry this mood into other meetings. Is that how we manage to be able to successfully work with one another? Is it a practice where we're learning to serve each other so someday we'll serve Krishna? How do we get along better in the boardroom as opposed to the temple room?
Yeah, the boardroom meetings are meant to develop plans and strategy. But the ultimate fulfillment of that meeting is an implementation of those plans and strategies. Right? If we don't implement, then what's the point in meeting? And in most cases, those meetings end up like that, you know. And lots of, you know, discussions, lots of debates, lots of conclusions, but no implementation. Whereas in Krishna consciousness, I mean, in reality, what we have to do is that whatever we resolve, that has to be practically applied. Right? And I don't know whether I'm able to explain this point clearly to you. I mean, is it clear? Like,
yes, that point is clear. That is the aspect of personalities and egos and all of us trying to be Vaishnavas. And, you know, are we pretending to be surrendered until we become surrendered? Are we silent in meetings if an authority, you know, if someone's louder or more advanced? Or do we trust that we're there to serve Krishna's purpose? And if we feel that our opinion might be valid, even though others disagree, it seems like we need to learn how to respect each other so we can have productive meetings. And at the same time, it seems like everything we do in ISKCON is preparing us to go back home, back to Godhead. So I guess avoiding the conflicts, avoiding the offenses, like how do we protect ourselves from the Vaishnava abroad in that setting? Because you become more vulnerable in that setting.
And all I can say is that, you know, if it is done with a proper attitude and purpose, then it will be meaningful. Like, let's meet together to figure out how we're going to spread Krishna consciousness. But if the meetings are meant just to establish ourselves, you know, then the main purpose is lost. Like, the meeting should be an exchange of, to have a forum to exchange our ideas, to serve Krishna better. And then again, you know, like, the best way actually is to sit at the feet of the higher authority and take the guidance from him, instructions from him, and act accordingly. That is the Vaishnava way of doing. But at the same time, Vaishnavas get together and discuss. But the ultimate process is that we have to accept the authority and act accordingly. You know, Krishna consciousness is democratic, but at the same time autocratic. You know, it's a perfect combination of both extremes, right? And just democracy by itself is not good, and autocracy by itself is not good. Like in a family, you know, a big family, It is both. The father is autocratic, but he is showering his affection to all the members of the family. And all the members of the family, they are together trying to please the father. So that is how it should be. Like, you see, the authority structure, the higher and lower consideration should be very clearly defined and followed. You know, but if we kind of develop a system that where everybody is equal, like we are all equal, but some are more equals, right? So then, you know, the whole purpose will be lost. And we are not equal. The father is not equal to the son. Grandfather is not equal to the grandson. The brothers may be equal. Even then, among the brothers, there's an older brother and younger brother. And so we have to find everybody's, our situation in relation to everyone around us. That's what we have to find. To some we are equal, to some we are junior, to some we are senior, and we have to act accordingly. It's not just one across the, you know, one relationship across the board. And the most important consideration is that this relationship should be based on love and trust. If we love, then we don't care whether one is senior. Like a boy and girl in love with each other, they don't consider, oh, you are senior, I'm junior. No, they're in love. That's what really matters. So in our relationship, in reality, it has to be based on that love. Then there won't be any consideration who is senior or junior. It automatically manifests. The love from the senior will be showered in the form of compassion and care. And love from the junior will rise towards the senior in the form of respect. And that is what will cause the bond.
Wow. Can you imagine, Maharaj? It sounds absolutely wonderful and doable. Can you imagine now to take this and implement it, just to walk in more surrendered? It sounds so much easier.
Krishna consciousness is so easy. Again, surrender is so easy. It's a struggle that is difficult, you know. So, thank you very much. Okay.